Tonight on Arena, Stephen Ray on remembering poet Derek Mahon in words and music, and Vivian Gornick looks back at half a century of writing in her latest collection of essays. is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, as you just heard on the nuach there, the Cúigiú Bouta, the fifth nomination for Cartoon Saloon in Kilkenny for Wolf Walkers last October. I spoke to Tom Moore and Ross Stewart about the film just ahead of its release. This morning we heard that fantastic news that it has been, Wolf Walkers has been nominated for an Oscar in the animated feature film category, and delighted to be joined once again by Tom Moore and Ross Stewart, directors of Wolf Walkers. Tom, as I said, the Cúigiú Bouta, the fifth go this time, at fifth up nomination. Congratulations, first of all. I presume one doesn't grow tired of getting Oscar nominations.
Well, you don't. You just start getting the fear that you'll break the streak, I suppose. So there's a degree of relief this morning as well as celebration, you know.
Did you feel the same thing too, Ross? Did you feel a kind of a pressure, given that, as I said, there had been four previous nominations? I think all three previous animated films were nominated, and one of them had two nominations along the way as well. So was there actually a pressure?
Loads of pressure. I mean, especially on me, because if it hadn't gotten the Oscar, they might have pointed the finger at me and said, you messed it up.
Because this was kind of mostly your baby, was it?
Well, no, it's just Tom has nominations for his first two features. Then I come along, and if we hadn't gotten a feature, I would have been the link.
There can't have been that much pressure all the same, given that, you know, there's been a Golden Globe nomination, there's been a BAFTA nomination as well. What does it actually mean, Tom? How important is it for you within the whole industry? What does this do, the Oscar nomination in particular?
Oh, it's massive. I mean, the first one really changed the fortunes of the studio. I think it really gave us the kind of impetus to keep going.
Was that for Book of Kells, yeah?
Yeah, for Secret of Kells. Yeah. And, like, just to be recognised by our peers in the industry like this is really amazing. And it means so much even for, like, new projects. We've got so many new projects coming up and new directors coming up and so on. And it's just kind of gives an extra eye on all the new projects that are coming out, I suppose.
And it also means, I suppose, for you, Ross, that you can go into the next production meeting and say, I was thinking I might direct the next one as well.
They might laugh me out of the room, I don't know. But I think, as Tom said, it definitely opens doors. And if Cartoon Saloon comes along to someone for distribution or for funding or anything like that, you know, they look at the resume, they see five Oscar nominations, and they take Cartoon Saloon much more seriously.
And I guess it also puts you in the company with Pixar and Disney, like really big corporations with a lot more money behind them, I would guess, than you guys
have. I have to say, like, we were just talking about this earlier. Wolfwalkers had a tenth of the budget of something like Soul. So it really is amazing. And you get complacent. It's a bit like Kilkenny with the All-Ireland. You can kind of get used to it. But, you know, you shouldn't get used to it because it's totally mad. Like a small studio, completely independent, in a small city in the middle of Ireland, and we're competing with those huge corporations. Now, the only thing that's special and different this time that really gives us an extra shot, I think, is the fact that we partnered with Apple TV Plus. And they've put so much into the marketing and all that, along with our usual partners like GKID and Wildcard here in Ireland, for example, we really have a bit of a better chance this time. But still, it's mad. It's really mad that, that a small studio and a small film like this would go as far. And we are pinching ourselves, you know. We're not taking it for granted.
And I wouldn't take the Kilkenny thing for granted either. There'll be a few counties around the country warning you on that one. But, you know, that's interesting, that point that, was it yourself, Tom or Ross? I'm not sure who made that point about Apple TV. But to the other one of you then, you know, the presence of Apple TV in the midst of this, I don't want to take the romance out of an Oscar nomination then everybody votes. Lobbying has to be done. You have to get the film out there and make sure that people actually see it before they cast their vote. How important is it to have a big corporation like Apple TV behind you?
Yeah, it's massive. I mean, what they've been doing since the release last September has just been incredible, even in the run-up to it. And now with the voting for the awards, they're trying to target, like, you know, all the guilds, all the different little groups that represent actors in the Academy and the different, like, you know, editors and cinematographers and everything. So they're really trying to make sure that every single person who can vote can see Wolfwalkers ahead of the vote. And it is something that we wouldn't have been able to, you know, dream of for the other films. Like, what, you know, Apple are able to do it because they're such a big company.
Yeah. And now let's talk a little bit about the film as well. I mean, it's just such a joy. I even from the time I first spoke to you about it just ahead of the release, you know, this English girl and this Irish girl, one of them a wolf walker, the other one the son, or the daughter rather, of the local English lord who's causing all sorts of troubles in and around Kilkenny. Let's have a listen to Robin, played by Anna Niecy, where she meets Maeve. That's Robin is the English character. Maeve, played by Eva Whittaker, is the Irish character. And they've just stumbled upon each other in Maeve's den. And, well, they don't hit it off well, do they?
Get away from me! But you're so slow! Scared of your shadows, yeah? So what would a Kerry know about wolves?
Why is that so much stuff?
Hey, stop! That's the gate for hunting!
Oh, a hunter?
A little girl like you!
Well, you're a girl too!
I'm no girl! I'm a wolf walker!
Wolf! Cut me ball!
When I sleep, I'm a wolf! When I'm awake, I'm me!
Tira!
What's your name, anyway?
Robin.
Robin? I like birds.
I'm so high. I'm so
caught again. Some hunter. That's two for me, none for you.
Whoa!
Touch of the Kilkenny there, isn't there? Two for me, none for you. Robin, played by Anna Niecy, and Maeve, played by Eva Whittaker, a scene there from Wolfwalkers, received its nomination today. Finally then, I'll come to you on this one, Ross. Have you any idea, April the 25th will be the ceremony. Will they actually make it? Will it be a full ceremony, do you think? Or are you going to just prepare something for yourselves in Kilkenny?
I think we'll have to prepare something for ourselves in Kilkenny. Much like the Golden Globes, you know, it's all virtual this year and they just want you looking in on a camera link. So we'll try and do some kind of socially distant event and we'll allow all the people in Cartoon Saloon to tune in and be able to watch it and stuff. But, you know, it'll be in the middle of the night, so we'll have to have some entertainment in the run-up to it. But between now and then, anyway, we have a good few weeks of different awards and different nominations and different things to look forward to. One of them is the St. Patrick's Day Festival, where Keel are going to be performing in front of the Wolfwalkers film, I think, for part of their part of their concert. Yeah, and I think that's been streamed, I think, on St. Patrick's Day. But yeah, if you look up the St. Patrick's Day Festival, they'll have details there.
Well, indeed, that perfectly leads me into my next item, which is about the St. Patrick's Day Festival too. But congratulations to you both, Tom and Ross, Tom Moore and Ross Stewart. Their best of luck with Wolfwalkers,
Thank
the Academy
you.
Awards. Yeah, but by the way, just before you go, let Tom and Ross know how astoundingly proud the people of Kilkenny City and County are. If Wolfwalkers wins nothing, it's an incredible, beautiful story and piece of art. We hope that this is the one, though. Sean O'Hargoyne, former mayor of Kilkenny. And I'd say a lot of people would join with Sean O'Hargoyne. Yeah. Fáilte Róth, agus Cogorjica Sarish, Tom Moore and Ross Stewart there of Wolfwalkers and Cartoon Saloon. Yet another award for them or nomination for them in the Oscar. On Thursday, March the 18th, in a collaboration between Tradfest and St. Patrick's Festival, a special one-off show will be streamed on the Tradfest website in order of poet Derek Mahan. Very sadly, he died last October. The show is hosted by actor Stephen Ray, who was not only a great admirer of Derek Mahan, but a good friend also. Stephen, how would you describe the body of work, first of all, that Derek Mahan has given us, that body of poetry?
Oh, well, it's huge, you know, because he's been writing for a very long time and he became even more industrious the older he got. And in some ways, it was a way of giving a discipline to his life, which occasionally hadn't been the case. But I visited him in Kinsale, and it was a house just given over to writing, and it was beautiful to see, you know. He would have kept on going, you know, there's no question. He hadn't finished.
And he, as you say, toward, for that latter part of his life, living in Kinsale, originally from Belfast, a neighbourhood and a part of Belfast not dissimilar to your own upbringing, Stephen. Do you see parallels in what he wrote and the Belfast you grew up in?
Well, we both came from North Belfast, although, and Basil Blackshaw, the painter, came from just up the road too, but none of us knew each other at that time, you know. Derek went to a different school to me and all that, you know. But when I got to know, and I always thought he was a wee bit academic for me, you know what I mean? But then when I started to get into the poetry, I absolutely adored it, you know. And he's superb, you know, and as a direct contemporary of Heaney's, and it's wonderful. And then at a certain point, I can't actually remember when I first met him, but probably at a poetry reading in Belfast. But eventually, we asked him to do a translation of a Molière play for Field Day, and it was kind of wonderful, you know. So, and very, very funny. So he was he wasn't like sober. Wrong word. He wasn't over serious, you know.
Yes,
he could be very, very funny.
Yeah, and that aspect that you say, it's interesting you draw up the comparison with Heaney. I mean, there are those that would say that Derek Mahon did for the urban Northern Ireland and Ireland what Heaney did for rural Ulster, if you like. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I mean, they did come from very different backgrounds in that sense. I mean, you know, Heaney came from a working farm, you know, and Derek came from a basically suburban house up the Antrim Road, and it was different. It was, and you know, and he went to Trinity, and Heaney just went to Queens, which was more the thing that people did from the north, you know. But the thing they had in common, of course, was, as with Michael Longley, they were great classical scholars. They were really steeped in Greek and Latin, and you can see that in the work, you know. And Derek, of course, on top of that, had French. You know, he was a fantastic scholar of French. So they. You know, I think that's the big lesson for anybody trying to write poetry, is that don't forget the original poems, you know, the classics.
And one of the things that you're doing in this tribute, Stephen, is, which I think is, if you think of that classical tradition, I'm not going, well, I suppose I am going back to Greek even when I talk about this, is this mixture of music and the spoken word, which I think is vital to it. I have a piece here featuring the poem The Dawn Chorus, and it's the harpist Brigine who's playing the music here. So let's just have a listen to that.
Dreams we miss. Listening, heartbroken to the dawn chorus, clutching to the certainty that once we flew, we yearn for that reality in this. Awaiting still our metamorphosis, we hoard the fragments of what once we knew. It is not sleep itself, but dreams we miss. We yearn for that reality in this.
And that's just a flavour of the Dawn Chorus there from the harpist Brigine, and it's part of the event we're speaking about this evening with Stephen Ray, a piece remembering Derek Mahon. It really is beautiful, the mix of harp in particular. When we get to the spoken word, there's something quite, I don't know how to describe it. It's a very traditional feel to it, first of all, but it's a kind of a primitive aspect to it, and I mean primitive in a very positive way, Stephen.
Yeah, and you know, that bridging is absolutely fabulous, you know. Just tremendous, her confidence and her capacity to restate what the harp is capable of. And then you have to remember that these younger people of, like, Derek Mahon's on the syllabus for the Leaving Cert, and everybody loves him. You know, it's like a discovery. Mm. You know, and Felicia, who was is also in our show, she. They just love it. They love him. You know, I think he's just in touch with them. You know?
Yeah, you mentioned Feli Speaks there as well. Let's have a listen to... She recites the poem Titanic, and very much this brings us into Belfast for sure when you hear Titanic as a poem title. Let's have a listen to her.
They said, I got away in a boat and humbled me at the inquiry. I swear I sank as far that night as any hero. As I sat shivering on the dark water, I turned to ice to hear my costly life go thundering down in a pandemonium of prams, pianos, sideboards, winches, boilers bursting, and shredded ragtime. Now I hide in a lonely house behind the sea where the tide leaves broken toys and hat boxes silently at my door. The showers of April, flowers of May mean nothing to me, nor the late light of June when my gardener describes to strangers how the old man stays in bed on seaward mornings after nights of wind, takes his morphine and sees no one. Then it is I drown again with all those dim lost faces I never understood. My poor soul screams out in the starlight, hearts break loose and rolls down like a stone. Include me in your commemorations.
After the Titanic, the full title of that poem from Derek Mahan, read there by Feli Speaks, and part of the tribute to Derek Mahan that Stephen Ray is hosting with Tradfest and the St. Patrick's Festival, part of Shoda, in fact, Culture Ireland's free online global festival of the arts from March the 17th through until the 21st. Really struck, Stephen, by... you know, a young artist like Feli Speaks, they're really known for her work in the spoken word form and the spoken word art form, how the poetry of Derek Mahan sits in her mouth so perfectly.
Oh, so her delivery is superb. It's absolutely beautiful. And then what she does in this show is she responds to Derek's poem with a poem of her own, which is absolutely brilliant. And She's telling us that we've had disasters before the pandemic, and you know, and we can recover from disaster. And it's just so it's so beautiful what the tone that she has. I mean, both these young musicians and poets are absolutely tremendous, you know, and they can go anywhere they like.
Yeah, and if some of your old friends are in here as well in terms of the music world, Neil Martin, Paddy Glack and Matt Malloy and Brian Connor also will be there with various pieces of music along the way. But given, I just want to go back to a line in the first poem that we heard from Brie Jean, this idea that it's not sleeps but the dreams that we miss. There's a great solace in poetry at the moment. It's something that has really struck me speaking to people on the programme in these, you know, this pandemic period when we're all locked down and we're not getting to do the work maybe that we want to get done. Poetry can provide us with something that maybe other art forms don't necessarily give us.
Well, I think it probably always did if it was there for, if it wasn't being hammered into in the wrong way at school or something, you know. But obviously what those girls are telling us is that they loved it at school. But I think it's the nearest spiritual equivalent to music. And so when you put them both together, particularly the kind of with the genius of these guys, these four guys, it's just mind blowing, you know.
Well, listen, I'm going to finish up with a poem that lots of people actually listened to from Derek Mahan during the I think it was the first lockdown that this poem really came to the fore. And it's you that'll be reciting it. And I'll give people details of where they can watch the event afterwards. But great to speak with you this evening, Stephen. Thanks for being with us.
Sean, thank you very much indeed.
That's Stephen Ray. And here he is then reciting the poem that I think lots of people really got used to and got great solace from during lockdown, the poetry of Derek Mahan.
Everything is going to be all right. How should I not be glad to contemplate the clouds clearing beyond the dormer window and a high tide reflected on the ceiling? There will be dying, There will be dying, but there's no need to go into that. The lines flow from the hand unbidden, and the hidden source is the watchful heart. The sun rises in spite of everything, and the far cities are beautiful and bright. I lie here in a riot of sunlight, watching the day break and the clouds flying. Everything is going to be all right.
Stephen Ray with Everything Is Going To Be All Right, the poetry of Derek Mahon. And a tribute to Derek Mahon will be streamed from 8 p.m. this Thursday, March the 18th, on the website of Tradfest Temple Bar. Streaming time is 8 p.m. Irish time, available to watch on demand for 7 days after that release. And this show is produced, as I said, by Tradfest Temple Bar in association with Fingal County Council and Culture Ireland, and supported once again by the Culture Ireland Show the Programme. Full details on tradfest.ie. On St. Patrick's Day this Wednesday, the Abbey Theatre will live stream Home, part one of its YouTube channel at 7 p.m. Home is a series of extracts from the testimonies of survivors of mother and baby homes and also from certain reports into these institutions. The extracts will be read by 46 women, survivors, artists and public figures, including Noel Brown, Jess Kavanagh and Olivia O'Leary. We're going to bring you three of those clips now. The first is the testimony of Tressa Reeves, read by Denise McCormick.
He was allowed to come into my room and he slept in the little cot at the foot of my bed. And I was told not to touch him because I was not to bond with him. That was for his other mother. So I sat on my hands and looked at him. And eventually I picked him out of the cot and I cuddled him. And I baptised him Andre. I gave him an exotic sounding name because I thought that when I came to look for him, he would be easier to find that way. Of course, that was not to be the case.
And now we have PJ Haverty's account, read by Hilda Fay.
And she said, I want to take my son with me. And they said, no, he's going to be fostered out. So she got work in Tuam as a cleaner in the hospital. And she was made pay 5 shillings a month for a child she could not see. And every week for 5.5 years, she knocked on that door. And the doors opened and they asked, what do you want? I want my son. I want to take him away from here. And they said, no. Go away.
And finally then, we end with the words of Margaret, read by Marion O'Dwyer.
One day the nuns sent me into Cork City for something. And when I came back, my daughter was gone. It is hard to explain how I was feeling at that time, but I'm sure you can imagine. Shortly after that, I was brought to a solicitor's office on Patrick's Hill and made swear on the Bible that I would never try and contact my daughter again. And then I was told to sign adoption papers. There was no one with me, only a nun from the convent. Remember, I was only 17, and I could not legally sign any document at that age.
And that's the voice of Marion O'Dwyer there. And before that, you heard Hilda Fay and Denise McCormick reading the testimonies of Margaret, PJ Haverty and Tressa Reeves, respectfully. And Home Part 1 streams at 7 p.m. on St. Patrick's Day, the 17th of March, on the Abbey Theatre's YouTube channel. It will be available to watch there for 4 months, free to view, but you can donate during the live stream. Donations will go to Barnardo's post-adoption service. And that brings us to 32 minutes past 7 on Monday night's Arena. Best known as an influential memoirist and critic, Vivian Gornick grew up in the Bronx in New York. She became a reporter for the Village Voice in 1969, chronicling the emergence of the feminist movement. For nearly 50 years, she has been writing incisive essays on culture, feminism and literature. And her new book, Taking a Long Look, is a collection of the best of these, starting with the most recent and working back to essays from the 1970s. Among the essays in the book, Gornick explores the writing of James Salter, Hannah Arendt and Primo Levi, while her essays on the 1970s feminist movement are both of their time and still pertinent today. But perhaps most vital of all in this collection is the emphasis on learning to know ourselves, a lifelong and sometimes painful process. I'm delighted to have Vivian Gornick join us on the programme this evening. Vivian, I'm just wondering, in the process of looking back at this almost 50 years of writing yourself and putting together this collection, did you learn something new about yourself, something that you hadn't noticed or hadn't come across before?
I learned how long and hard was my apprenticeship at teaching myself how to write. That is what I learned, looking at all this stuff. I was immensely struck by how rhetorical much of my writing was as a young woman, especially as I saw myself on the barricades for radical feminism. The rhetoric just seemed to pour out of me. I think everything I wrote is still intellectually true, is still intellectually available, but I was very happy to see how the writing changed over 30, 40 years.
So what was it? I mean, you've spoken about, and you speak about this, in fact, in the introduction to the book. You talk about leaving polemical journalism, I think is the precise sentence you use. In fact, I can remember the exact moment when I left polemical journalism. So was there something in those early works, the polemics, were they too on the nose?
Polemical writing, as opposed to, say, imaginative writing or... imaginative writing, whether fictional or non-fictional. Polemical writing starts out with an agenda. It's somewhat like theory. The way theory approaches a work of literature with the intention of forcing the work into the polemic. Right? I mean, you're making whatever it is you're looking at serve the polemic or the theory. You're making the work serve the theory. It's the same with polemics. I set out as a feminist to find sexism, and which wasn't hard to do, and and so I found it and I applied it to whatever I was looking at. A rally, a book, a play, a dinner party. I saw it everywhere. Mm. And so essentially I was a polemicist. The work was good to the degree that it let what I was looking at be itself, but to the degree that it forced it into some polemical box, it wasn't. However, it was an immensely useful piece of training. It taught me a lot.
Do I hear a trace of, I don't know if regret is the right word, is there something in there? Do you have an odd relationship with those early writings then, where the polemics were more to the fore?
Well, yes, I do. I mean, polemical writing forces upon you certain phrases. When I say rhetorical, I mean... the writing is, rhetorical is the opposite of the writing struggling to let what you're looking at be itself, and your job is to describe it. And that is whatever is on the boards, an emotional state of being, a set of characters, some circumstance that you are struggling to understand. If you're a polemicist, you start with a polemic, and you force whatever you're looking at, into the kind of boundaries that the polemic. Imagine a Marxist writing. He always sees everything in terms of class struggle. I saw everything in terms of sexism. So there were lots of other ways in which to look at everything that we were looking at, but I didn't. So that's the way it was. It's very simple, and it's an easy kind of life if it doesn't grate on you. But after a while, it did. I mean, it just... Otherwise, I wouldn't have become a writer. I would have remained... I wouldn't have become the writer that I did become. Well, let's
I'll ask you then to recall that moment, as you do, as I say early on in the introduction, you recall the precise moment when you changed from that polemical style of writing into what you refer to as a kind of non-fiction storytelling. What happened?
You know, I don't remember myself. What did I write after that?
You said you sat down at a makeshift desk in a beachfront hotel and found yourself typing, "I'm 8 years old. My mother and I come out of our apartment onto the second floor land."
Okay, right. It was the moment I began to write the memoir, Fierce Attachment.
Yes.
That is very true. In that moment... Well, it is just as I said. I mean, I was overcome by the urge suddenly to look inward instead of outward. I suddenly got really tired as a journalist of being a stranger in other people's lives. I suddenly, if you can live with this paradox, I wanted to be a stranger in my own life. I wanted to look inward instead of outward. And that grew in me. It was very telling in the sense that, like, you know, it was like I was struggling with myself the way you might struggle with yourself to get out of a bad marriage. You know, it takes time before you can figure out what you're really thinking and feeling. And it was the same with this. I struggled because life as a journalist was good. I liked it. And I saw no reason to not go on being like that until suddenly I began to struggle with myself. I really didn't want to do it anymore. And at the same time, feminism being where it was and New York being so full of it, I suddenly saw for the first time that my relationship to my mother was a potential subject. And then I saw that it was a memoir that I was to write, not a novel, as you know, everyone of my generation was raised to write a great American novel. But when I saw those two things... That was the beginning of the end of my life as a polemicist.
When you realized that it was going to be about your relationship with your mother, which was, let's face it, a fraught enough relationship a lot of the time, did you draw a breath inwards and think, "Oh Lord, why is this the solution to my problem?" Or did you tackle it with relish?
No, the first. I thought, "Oh Lord, why have you done this to me?" And, you know, my mother was very much alive, and she knew that I was writing it, and every now and then she would say to me, "Why are you writing this, so that the whole world will know that you hate me?" And then I would quail, and I would go home, and I would not be able to write for about 3 days. And then I would recover myself and realize this is my material, not hers. It's my experience. And I trusted the honesty of my enterprise. I knew that I was not writing to trash her or to aggrandize myself. I knew that, both as a writer and as a person. Because as a writer, I already knew that if you, the narrator, are trashing the subject, you are not reliable. And I knew already that nonfiction writing did not work if the narrator is unreliable. So I trusted that, and I thought in time my mother would too. And she did in the end. She did. She saw that I was not writing in order to grieve against her, that I didn't have a bill of grievance here, that was not why it was not Mommy Dearest I was not writing in order to... to cast myself as a victim and her as a victimizer. But it was hard.
Yeah, I can imagine that it was difficult. I mean, what were the things that you had to say, to be honest and to be truthful to yourself and to the material that you were handling, because that's what you were doing as this, I think I've heard you refer to yourself almost as a composer rather than anything, you know, rather than a novelist. Well, certainly not a novelist, but that there's a composition. There's a compositional element to it. You're getting the material and manipulating it around into the order you want to tell it, into the way that you want to tell it. What were the aspects of the composition that kept getting pushed out to the side? Do I have to put that phrase in? Do I have to put that particular aspect of our relationship into the public glare?
Yeah, well, I felt I was speaking hard truths. And the hard truth is always many faceted. I can couldn't just say my mother was a good woman. She wasn't just a good woman, anything remotely like that. Almost every aspect of our relationship was indeed fraught. And what does fraught mean? It means it was complicated. So there were lots of things that she did and I that we did together that were grievous. And those grievances are hardly ever admitted to. And in any sentimental work about the mother and the daughter or, you know, family stuff, for most of the years of my life, that kind of writing was sentimental. Hmm. The mother was a fount of love and devotion and support, and that's nonsense, you know. So, and in my case, I identified strongly with my mother, and that identification is made it almost impossible to grow up, to become myself, to leave home. And at the very end of the book, my mother says to me, "What? She's smarter than I realized." You know, I mean, well, she was very smart all the way mm-hmm. through. But at the end, she says to me, "Why don't you go already? I'm not stopping you." And I realize that she's not stopping me. I am stopping me. And essentially, I wrote the book in order to dramatize that moment. It actually happened. And I knew what it was all about.
Yes, found the answer to why you were writing the book when you got to the very end of the book, which is reasonable enough
happen. The very end was actually my beginning.
All right.
I mean, I saw that as I said, I was working towards that ending. I already had that in my head. I knew what it meant. And I determined to write a book that would dramatize and move towards that moment so that it would earn itself.
That
was my apprenticeship as a writer.
Yeah, and it was, I suppose, from that point on, the essays that we're speaking about began to roll out, really. Although the specifics of some of them that I want to talk about, I'm looking at... It goes in reverse chronological order, by the way. You start with the most recent essays and you work your way back. Is that... No, let me not put my little theory in front of you. Why did you do it that way?
Because I realized I believed in my own progress as a writer. I realized if I put the first stuff at the beginning, people will have to endure the writing that I think is the least good in order to get to the good stuff. I decided the hell with that. I would put the good stuff first and... let them go where they want after that. That was raison d'etre.
I have to admit that is not 1,000 miles off my pathetic little theory. I wondered if it was precisely that. There you go. Now, that's not to say that the essay that I want to speak about, which is towards the end of the book, that is because of all its flaws that I want to speak. No, I want to talk specifically about, you know, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 essays at the end of the book, Essays in Feminism, from your 1978 collections, your 1978 collection, and specifically Consciousness, which really looks at, I suppose, there's a line where you talk about the small, anonymous, conscious-raising group was the heart and soul of the women's movement. You're talking about women's groups, small groups coming together and basically sharing their experiences, talking to each other. What is at the heart, or was, in your mind, at the heart of the feminist movement back in the 70s?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was a little bit of genius, the discovery and the development of the consciousness-raising group. And it was a mixture. It was very smart women who put that whole thing together. It was really, as we all said, a mixture of Marx and Freud. In other words, what was said subsequently, the personal is political. It was really based on that sentence where groups of women suddenly were seeing the aim of all of those consciousness-raising groups was to interpret your experience in terms of sexism, to suddenly speak about your own experience, not as you always did before, but in this new light, and that was the Marx part of it. Mm. The Freudian part was obvious, the analysis that you were beginning to give of your life, not in the old terms, not in the old personal terms, like, oh, gee, this is happening to me. I can't imagine it happens to anybody else. It was the other way around. you were looking for what was similar, what you had all experienced without realizing it. And it worked brilliantly. It was very much of its moment, and it was just a little bit of genius, and it worked on thousands upon thousands of women all over the country.
The other aspect of it, you speak about this happening in the 1970s, you know, women coming together and saying, this happened to me, did it happen to you? Or did something similar happen to you? Tell me about your experience, etc. I mean, we're talking something very close to the Me Too movement of recent years. Do you see similarities there?
Well, only to some degree. We were very political. We were consciously political. And most of us came out of the New Left. You know, we were a generation of feminists who... we were the first, like, in 100 years, I'd say, practically. No, maybe 50, at least 50, at least since the 1920s. But we were a generation that was very conscious of seeing ourselves politically and historically and culturally. The women of today, the Me Too movement, the women of today are, first of all, not political in the way that we were. And secondly, they are in a much greater rage than we were. The reason being that subconsciously they had absorbed us and thought that the world was supposed to change and was supposed to change a lot more than it actually did. So what the Me Too movement is feeling is too little, very late. And that works, stands on the shoulders of 1970s feminism. If it wasn't for that subliminal promise that 1970s feminism offered, promised, you would not have the rage that you have now, not only in America, but almost all over the Western world. It's been a shock to me to see the recovering of feminist thought and feeling all over Europe, and all over the UK. It's been a shocker. And I know that it's because, subliminally, my generation promised the world is going to change, and it didn't, not sufficient. It has changed a lot. I mean, we did make a revolution in many ways, but in many ways, obviously, it has remained more painfully the same. And that's what Me Too represents and embodies. And also, it's a whole different style of being. Mostly they're creatures of the internet, which is a whole different way. We were out in the streets.
Yeah.
One question on that, though,
because I want to talk to something else before we finish up. How important, how useful is rage?
Well, you see, from the Me Too movement, rage has had the most stunning effect. I mean, it's like the French Revolution, off with his head. And indeed, his head is coming off. It was unbelievable to us that that the anger of women today, and it's happening now in Britain, you know, this huge protest that's going on now in England because of the death of this young woman right on the streets. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I mean, look at the outpouring, the incredible outpouring of anger that has come about because of that. It's the anger is always. It's a tremendous stimulant, it's uncontrollable.
I know.
That's the thing. It's uncontrollable, and it's. Goes to the good and it goes to the bad. I mean, as far as the Me Too movement is concerned, the ability to have affected the lives of so many men of power in so negative a way is stunning. I don't think it ever could have happened before. And their anger is murderous, really murderous.
Let me finish, if I could, then, Vivian, with one question, because I just want to cover another aspect of the collection of essays, which is this section on culture and specifically Uncle Tom's Cabin and the anti-slavery novel by Harriet Beecher Stowe. You give us a new reading of this book, maybe a more positive reading of it. Does this feed into the Black Lives Matter situation that we're dealing with at the moment?
Well, essentially that what that piece demonstrates is that at the heart of the lack of progress against racism is the weak will of liberalism. That's at the heart of that piece. So, you know, in that sense, yeah, why not? Sure. I mean, it's really what it's all about. It's the weak will. It is the weak will of the middle, of the great educated middle that doesn't have enough of a... It always is. All the liberationist movements, they are all trained on that huge middle that it falls immediately into inertia when a great injustice is proposed. When the, you know, the I'm losing words.
Do you know what
the proposal of curing a great injustice comes about, it's that inertia that takes that makes social change take forever. It's not the few at the top or the bottom, because they Me Too, by the way, proved that capitalism should have caved in, as it did, to the Me Too yelling and screaming. It was the biggest shock of the moment. It's not them, really, I think, that is the cause of everything taking forever to change. It's, as I said, that great educated middle and liberals, people who consider themselves liberals. Yeah.
It's lovely to have spoken to you. It's hardly surprising that we can't squeeze 50 years into 15 minutes, but it's been a joy to get some of it in there at any rate. And thanks a million for being with us this evening. That's Vivian Gornick.
And you will edit out my stuttering, right?
Yeah. No, because this is live. So that is, the world has heard you like that.
Oh, God.
Well, there you go. And no harm with it. Vivian, lovely to speak with you. Thanks for that. That's Vivian Gornick there. And taking a look back, that book of essays published by Verso. Vivian will be in conversation with Sinead Gleeson on Friday, the 20th of May, 6 p.m. as part of the International Literature Festival Dublin. Further information on ilfdublin.com.
This March, writers Rebecca Solnit, Noam Chomsky, Zadie Smith, Max Porter, Paula Meehan, Evan Osnos, Daniel McLaughlin and many others will invite you into their worlds of poetry, fiction and non-fiction. Mountains to See DLR Book Festival, brought to you by Dunleary Rathdown County Council, will delight and inspire people of all ages. Visit mountainstosee.ie and get the full story.
RTE supporting the arts.
Supporting artists.
Supporting us.
Dry Cleaning is the curious name of a post-punk band from South London, fronted by spoken word vocalist and performer Florence Shaw. Their debut single back in 2019 was entitled Magic of Meghan, or Meehan, written on the day that Meghan Markle and Prince Henry announced their engagement. Coincidentally, the same day that Florence moved out of her former partner's apartment following their breakup. Now, we've probably had enough of Meghan and Henry, have we, over the last week or two? So maybe we will play the latest single from Dry Cleaning, a foretaste of their highly anticipated debut album due on April the 2nd. It's Dry Cleaning, and the track title is Scratch Card Lanyard.
A woman in aviators firing a bazooka. I've come here to make a ceramic shoe, and I've come to smash what you made. I've come to learn how to mingle. I've come to learn how to dance. Join a knitting circle. That's just child chat. Why don't you want oven chips?
Specialising in great names, a track called Scratch Card Lanyard from a post-punk artist called Dry Cleaning. That is our lot for this Monday evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Dave Gibson was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGann. Bemi Arash Liv, Iha Mark on Shahar RT Radio Hain. Shock the Club.